ahead. It sounded fine to him, but go ahead on my own. He happened to know that Gaston, Hall Johnson's manager, wanted me headed off. He saw in my idea a threat to Hall Johnson's group. You are being strung along on this rehearsal gag to throw you off. Go ahead on your own. So I went ahead. We rehearsed at my house, here and there and anywhere. The secretary to John Golden liked the idea after seeing a rehearsal and got me the theater. She undertook to handle the press for me, so I just turned over the money to her, and she did well by me. I had talked godmother, Mrs. R. Osgood Mason, into helping me. Dr. Locke, her main Negro confidant, had opposed it at first, but he was finally won over. You see, he had been born in Philadelphia, educated at Harvard and Oxford, and had never known the common run of Negroes. He was not at all sympathetic to our expression. To his credit, he has changed his viewpoint. Then came that Sunday night of the 10th. We had a good house, mostly white shirt fronts and ermine. Godmother was out there sitting close enough for me to see her and encourage me. Locke was there, too, in faultless tails. He came backstage to give me a pat of encouragement and went back out front. I needed it. I was as nervous as I could be. And if I had known then as much as I know now, I would have been even more nervous. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. From the lifting of the curtain on the dawn scene where the shack rouser awakens the camp to the end of the first half, it was evident that the audience was with us. The male chorus lined track and spiked to tremendous applause. The curtain had to be lifted and lowered and then again. I was standing there in the wings, still shivering, when Lee Whipper, who had played the part of the itinerant preacher in a beautiful manner, gave me a shove, and I found myself out on the stage. A tremendous burst of applause met me, and so I had to say something. I explained why I had done it, that music without motion was unnatural with Negroes, and what I had tried to do was to present Negro singing in a natural way, with action. I don't know what else I said, but the audience was kind, and I walked off to an applauding house. Right here, let me set something straight. Godmother had meant for me to call Dr. Locke to the stage to make any explanations, but she had not told me. Neither had Locke told me. I was stupid. When he told me where he would be sitting, he evidently thought that would be enough. But I had not thought of any speech in all my troubles of rehearsals, making costumes and keeping things going. It just had not occurred to me. I would not have been out there myself if Lee Whipper had not shoved me. I found out later that I had seemed to ignore Dr. Locke, for which I am very sorry. I would have much rather had him make a thought-out speech than my improvising. It just did not occur to me in all my excitement. It may be too late, but I ask him please to pardon me. He had been helpful, and I meant him good. The second half of the program went off even better than the first. As soon as the curtain went up on the fire dancers, their costuming got a hand. It broke out time and again during the dancing and thundered as Carolyn Rich and Strawn executed the last movement with the group as a background. It was good it was the last thing, for nothing could have followed it. Hal Johnson did a generous thing. I had sent tickets and he and his manager came backstage and Hal said, "You proved your point all right. When you talked to me about it, it sounded like a crazy mess. I really came to see you do a flop, but it was swell." I thought that was fine of Hall. The New School of Social Research presented us 6 weeks later, and we danced at the Vanderbilt, Nyack, and various places. But I was worn out with backstage arguments, eternal demands for money, a disturbance in my dance group because one of the men who was incidentally the poorest dancer of all preached that I was an American exploiting them and they ought to go ahead under his guidance. Stew Beef, Lias Strawn, and Motorboat pointed out to him that they had never dreamed of dancing in public until I had picked them up. I had rehearsed them for months fed them, and routined them into something. Why had he never thought of it before I did? He had discouraged the others from joining me until it began to look successful, so they meant to stick with me, American or no American. But two of the women joined the troublemaker, and I fired all three of them. The whole thing was beginning to wear me down. When some other things began to annoy me, I decided to go home to Florida and try to write the book I had in mind, which was Jonas Gourdvine. Before it was hardly started, I heard that Hall Johnson had raided my group and was using it in his Run Little Chillin'. I never saw the production, but I was told that the religious scene was the spitting image of the one from my concert also. As I said, I never saw it, so I wouldn't know. But this I do know, that people became very much alive to West Indian dancing and work songs. I have heard myself over the air dozens of times and felt the influence of that concert running through what has been done since. My name is never mentioned, of course, because that is not the way theater people do things. But that concert and the rave notices I got from the critics shoved the viewpoint over towards the natural Negro. Theater Arts Magazine photographed us and presented us in its April issue following the concert at the John Golden. The Folk Dance Society presented us at the Vanderbilt. We appeared at the first National Folk Festival in St. Louis in 1934, at Chicago in 1934, and at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. In Chicago, I had only 10 days to try to prepare a full-length program, and it was not smooth, considering that I had only very raw material to work with in so short a time. But at that, the dancers and a dramatic bit went over splendidly and got good notices. Catherine Dunham loaned us her studio for rehearsal twice, which was kind of her. Anyway, West Indian dancing had gone west and created interest just as it had done in the east. When I got to Jamaica on my first Guggenheim Fellowship in 1936, I found that Catherine Dunham had been there a few months before collecting dances and had gone on to Haiti. I made no real money out of my concert work. I might have done so if I had taken it up as a life work. But I am satisfied in knowing that I established a trend and pointed Negro expression back towards the saner ground of our own unbelievable originality. Chronology. January 7th, 1891, born in Notasulga, Alabama, the fifth of eight children, to John Hurston, a carpenter and Baptist preacher, and Lucy Potts Hurston, a former school teacher. September 1917 to June 1918, attends Morgan Academy in Baltimore, completing the high school requirements. Summer 1918, works as a waitress in a nightclub and a manicurist in a black-owned barbershop that serves only whites. 1918 to 19, attends Howard Prep School, Washington, D.C. 1919 to 1924, attends Howard University, receives an associate degree in 1920. 1921, publishes her first story, John Redding Goes to Sea, in The Stylus, the campus literary society's magazine. December 1924, publishes Drenched in Light, a short story in Opportunity. 1925, submits a story, Spunk, and a play, Color Struck, to Opportunity's literary contest. Both win second place awards. Publishes Spunk in the June number. 1925 to 27, attends Barnard College, studying anthropology with Franz Boas. 1926, begins field work for Boas in Harlem. January 1926, publishes John Redding Goes to Sea in Opportunity. Summer 1926, organizes Fire, with Langston Hughes and Wallace Thurman. They publish only one issue in November 1926. The issue includes Hurston's Sweat. August 1926 publishes Mutsy in Opportunity. September 1926 publishes Possum or Pig in The Forum. September to November 1926 publishes The Eatonville Anthology in The Messenger. 1927 publishes the first one, a play, in Charles S. Johnson's Ebony and Topaz. February 1927 goes to Florida to collect folklore. May 19, 1927, marries Herbert Sheen. September 1927, first visits Mrs. Rufus Osgood Mason, seeking patronage. October 1927, publishes an account of the black settlement at St. Augustine, Florida, in the Journal of Negro History. Also in this issue, Cujo's own story of the last African slaver. December 1927, signs a contract with Mason, enabling her to return to the South to collect folklore. 1928, satirized as Sweetie Mae Carr in Wallace Thurman's novel about the Harlem Renaissance, Infants of the Spring, receives a Bachelor of Arts degree from Barnard. January 1928, relations with Sheen break off. May 1928 publishes How It Feels to Be Colored Me in The World Tomorrow. 1930-32 organizes the field notes that become Mules and Men. May to June 1930 works on the play Mule Bone with Langston Hughes. 1931 publishes Hoodoo in America in the Journal of American Folklore. February 1931 breaks with Langston Hughes over the authorship of Mule Bone. July 7, 1931, divorces Sheen. September 1931, writes for a theatrical review called Fast and Virtuous. January 1932, writes and stages a theatrical review called The Great Day, first performed on January 10th on Broadway at the John Golden Theater. Works with the Creative Literature Department of Rollins College, Winter Park, Florida, to produce a concert program of Negro music. 1933 writes The Fiery Chariot. January 1933 stages From Sun to Sun, a version of Great Day, at Rollins College. August 1933 publishes The Gilded Six Bits in Story. 1934 publishes six essays in Nancy Cunard's anthology, Negro. January 1934 goes to Bethune-Cookman College to establish a school of dramatic arts based on pure Negro expression. May 1934 publishes Jonas Gordvine, originally titled Big Nigger. It is a Book of the Month Club selection. September 1934 publishes The Fire and the Cloud in The Challenge. November 1934, Singing Steel, a version of Great Day, performed in Chicago. January 1935, makes an abortive attempt to study for a Ph.D. in anthropology at Columbia University on a fellowship from the Rosenwald Foundation. In fact, she seldom attends classes. August 1935 joins the WPA Federal Theater Project as a dramatic coach. October 1935, Mules and Men published. March 1936, awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship to study West Indian obeah practices. April to September 1936, in Jamaica. September to March 1937, in Haiti, writes, their eyes were watching God in 7 weeks. May 1937 returns to Haiti on a renewed Guggenheim. September 1937 returns to the United States. Their eyes were watching God published September 18th. February to March 1938 writes, Tell My Horse. It is published the same year. April 1938 joins the Federal Writers Project in Florida to work on The Florida Negro. 1939 publishes Now Take Noses in Cordially Yours. June 1939 receives an honorary Doctor of Letters degree from Morgan State College. June 27, 1939, marries Albert Price III in Florida. Summer 1939, hired as a drama instructor by North Carolina College for Negroes at Durham, meets Paul Green, professor of drama, at the University of North Carolina. November 1939, Moses, Man of the Mountain, published. February 1940, files for divorce from Price, though the two are reconciled briefly. Summer 1940, makes a folklore collecting trip to South Carolina. Spring to July of 1941, writes Dust Tracks on a Road. July 1941, publishes Cock Robin, Beale Street, in the Southern Literary Messenger. October 1941 to January 1942, works as a story consultant at Paramount Pictures. July 1942, publishes Story in Harlem Slang in the American Mercury. September 5, 1942, publishes a profile of Lawrence Silas in the Saturday Evening Post. November 1942, Dust Tracks on a Road, published. February 1943, awarded the Annisfield Wolf Book Award in Race Relations for Dust Tracks on the cover of the Saturday Review. March 1943, receives Howard University's Distinguished Alumni Award. May 1943, publishes The Pet Negro Syndrome in the American Mercury. November 1943, divorce from Price granted. June 1944, publishes My Most Humiliating Jim Crow Experience in the Negro Digest. 1945, writes Mrs. Doctor, it is rejected by Lippincott. March 1945, publishes The Rise of the Begging Joints in the American Mercury. December 1945 publishes Crazy for This Democracy in the Negro Digest. 1947 publishes a review of Robert Talent's Voodoo in New Orleans in the Journal of American Folklore. May 1947 goes to British Honduras to research black communities in Central America, writes Seraph on the Suwanee. Stays in Honduras until March 1948. September 1948, falsely accused of molesting a 10-year-old boy and arrested. Case finally dismissed in March 1949. October 1948, Seraph on the Suwanee published. March 1950, publishes Conscience of the Court in the Saturday Evening Post, while working as a maid in Revo Island, Florida. April 1950, publishes What White Publishers Won't Print in the Saturday Evening Post. November 1950, publishes I Saw Negro Votes Peddled in the American Legion magazine. Winter 1950 to 1951, moves to Belle Glade, Florida. June 1951, publishes Why the Negro Won't Buy Communism in the American Legion magazine. December 8, 1951, publishes A Negro Voter Sizes Up Taft in the Saturday Evening Post. 1952, hired by the Pittsburgh Courier to cover the Ruby McCollum case. May 1956, receives an award for education and human relations at Bethune-Cookman College. June 1956, works as a librarian at Patrick Air Force Base in Florida. Fired in 1957. 1957 to 1959, writes a column on hoodoo and black magic for the Fort Pierce Chronicle. 1958, works as a substitute teacher at Lincoln Park Academy, Fort Pierce. Early 1959, suffers a stroke. October 1959, forced to enter the St. Lucie County Welfare Home. January 28, 1960, dies in the St. Lucie County Welfare Home of hypertensive heart disease, buried in an unmarked grave in the Garden of Heavenly Rest, Fort Pierce. August 1973, Alice Walker discovers and marks Hurston's grave. March 1975, Walker publishes In Search of Zora Neale Hurston, in Ms., launching a Hurston revival. This is Bonnie Turpin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Dust Tracks on a Road by Zora Neale Hurston. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive Producer Suzanne Mitchell. Text copyright 1942 by Zora Neale Hurston. Renewed 1970 by John C. Hurston. Previously unpublished passages copyright 1996 by the estate of Zora Neale Hurston. Chronology copyright 1990 by Henry Louis Gates. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers, all rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.